and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with what was advertised as a major address on the economy that Donald Trump delivered today to the Detroit Economic Club, in which he gave away the store to the wealthiest of the 1% while reaching out to downsized workers in the Rust Belt states whose jobs have been outsourced. Economist James Galbraith, a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas and author of Welcome to the Poison Chalice, The Destruction of Greece and the Future of Europe, joins us to discuss Trump's portrayal of himself as the deliverer of jobs and prosperity while casting his opponent as the steward of stagnation. Then we'll look into the crisis in journalism that the Trump campaign has brought about, which is making life uncomfortable for mainstream non-opinion journalists who privately find Trump a dangerous demagogue but publicly have to stick to the textbook of fair and balanced American journalism. David Mindich, a professor and former chair of Media Studies, Journalism and the Digital Arts at St. Michael's College and author of Just the Facts, How Objectivity Came to Define American Journalism, joins us to discuss his article at the Columbia Journalism Review for journalists covering Trump, A Murrow Moment, and whether Trump's role as the GOP candidate for president confers a dignity on the hateful racist whose outrageous statements objective journalists may lose sight of. Then finally, we'll analyze Donald Trump's authoritarian tendencies with Jonathan Weiler, the author of Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics, and discuss his article at the Huffington Post, Understanding Trump, It's Still the Authoritarianism Stupid, in which Weiler argues that after decades of Republican dog-whistle racism and the demonization of the other, the GOP has created the conditions in which a Frankenstein monster has been able to emerge. And joining us now is James Galbraith, a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also a senior scholar at the Levy Economics Institute and serves as chair of the Board of Economists for Peace and Security. His books include Inequality and Instability, A Study of the World Economy Just Before the Great Crisis, The End of Normal, The Great Crisis, and The Future of Growth, and his latest, Welcome to the Poison Chalice, The Destruction of Greece and the Future of Europe. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galbraith.
Thank you very much.
And today, Donald Trump, the Republican candidate for President of the United States, gave a much anticipated, shall we say, speech on the economy before the Detroit Economic Club. And interesting enough, he said he wanted to have a conversation about how to make America great again for everyone. But that's a sort of a subtle shift, isn't it? Because prior to that, he's always said, I'm going to make America great without saying how. Now is he backing down, saying, well, he may not have the magic bullet, but let's have a conversation?
Well, that's a question of political rhetoric and tactics. I've read through the speech, and I think the interesting thing would be to try and summarize what it is exactly that Trump is proposing here. It is an economic speech. It's got an economic strategy. And I think it's very interesting to ask exactly what it is and what it would mean for a state like Michigan.
Well, we should go through it because my reading of it is it's almost like the status quo ante back to 2007 before the crash.
No. It's the status quo ante back to 1980.
Okay.
If you look at this speech, it brings me right back to the start of my professional career as an economist, which was Ronald Reagan's campaign in the first year of his administration. It's pretty much taken from that playbook. It is about cutting and simplifying the income tax. There's an elimination of the estate tax, which nobody in his audience or even within several leagues of the earnings of that audience actually pays. The cutting of allegedly job-killing regulations. Plus a policy of unleashing the coal industry again in order to produce and burn a lot more coal. All of that was essentially in the Reagan program in 1980. What happened in the state of Michigan in 1981-82 was the most disastrous crash of heavy industry, of the automobile industry, and in the upper Midwest, of the steel industry that we've ever seen, and from which that part of the country never recovered. So it's really very curious that he's touting the policies of the very administration whose actions were fundamental toward the destruction of the industrial base and the unionized working classes of the United States. And it will be very interesting to see whether he gets away with it.
Well, and specifically, he did take the example of the problems that Detroit has and say, and pinning that on Hillary Clinton. And even though you're talking about bigger issues like the states and the Rust Belt and the American economy, nevertheless, just to focus on Detroit, the problems
Detroit
with
Detroit was a harbinger. The bankruptcy of the Chrysler Corporation, which was headquartered in Detroit, occurred in 1979. That was just before the Reagan administration took office. The complete crash of the automobile and machine tool and heavy industry sector of the upper Midwest, from International Harvester, Caterpillar, Tractor, any number of firms that you can talk about that took severe blows or went out of business at that time, was the result of the policies of the Reagan administration in its first few years, policies which combined massive tax cuts and massive increases in interest rates to offset the effect of those tax cuts. So it was... it's very interesting to see that Trump is resurrecting the myth that the Reagan administration was good for economic growth and attempting to persuade people that somehow the decline of American industry only began in the 1990s. It's completely not true. It was the biggest crash was in the 1980s under the very policies he's now advocating.
Well, but just in terms of what happened to Detroit subsequently and at the moment, what's happened is that in effect, because it is a Democratic stronghold, as is Flint, Michigan, the rural Republicans led by the governor, Schneider, who's largely responsible for the poisoning of those children in Flint, the draconian and unnecessary bankruptcies that he imposed on the cities and the austerity are really more, I think, exacerbated the problem more than the problem existed in the first place.
Well, that's certainly true. You have in those towns concentrations of Democratic voters, in many cases minority voters, and they contribute no support to the Republicans who have become dominant in the state as labor as a whole has declined. And so they get squeezed politically and economically and socially by the state government. That clearly is also the case. Now, it will just be, as I say, the speech is very simple. It's very clear. It will be very interesting to see whether it really resonates with the people it's addressed to, because they live there. And I would suspect that there are certain points in the speech that I think probably coincide with their core beliefs, particularly what Trump said about the effect of NAFTA, that may resonate with these voters. But broadly speaking, if historical memory is served correctly, what we're looking at, as I say, is a strategy that is going to benefit an entirely different segment of the population from the one that Donald Trump was actually speaking to today.
So let's go through some of what Donald Trump talked about today before the Detroit Economic Club, because he was interrupted 14 times by protesters, but he didn't resort to his usual antics of deriding them, but rather, I think this is the new Donald Trump who last Friday in Green Bay, Wisconsin, somewhat reluctantly read the script to endorse the House Speaker and John McCain. So he's certainly behaving himself in the sense that he's curtailing his instincts. And of course, he's made it clear that he wants to get rid of Dodd-Frank and Obamacare, neither of which he brought up today. But he did bring up the so-called death tax. And as you pointed
out, he brought up Obamacare, too, and said he would replace it. He did not say with what.
Right. Well, I mean, I don't think he brought up Dodd-Frank, but it's worth noting that he wants to get rid of that. But this death tax is such a red herring. The estate tax currently exempts the first $5.45 million for an individual and $10.9 million for a married couple. So clearly, that getting rid of that would benefit him if he's the billionaire that he claims to be.
Well, what the estate tax really does in our society and has done for a century is to give people who've accumulated wealth a great incentive to deed it to universities, hospitals, churches, and if they're very wealthy, to create foundations. And that has created a vast nonprofit sector in the United States, which is a major source of economic strength. It provides about 8% of all of our jobs, has been a very important source of our strong jobs performance. And it provides, it recycles these accumulations so that they start getting spent even before the people who first accumulated them are gone. It also helps to reduce the amount of political dynasty building and social and economic dynasty building that actually would otherwise occur. So it's a very important tax for maintaining social balance and employment in the United States. Getting rid of it is a very bad idea.
So let's move on to then cutting the corporate income tax rate to 15% from its current 35%. No mention of repatriating all of those corporate trillions stashed offshore.
Well, I think you did mention that, actually. I'm not sure exactly how it would be achieved, but that is certainly one thing he did mention. He mentioned eliminating the carried interest deduction. I put a check mark in front of that. So this is an interesting set of details. Are they an economic panacea? No, because when corporations are making profits, they can pay the tax and still have very substantial profits left over. When they aren't making profits, then there is no tax to pay. Corporate income tax is a tax on net income, not gross income. And so in order for it to be relevant, you already have to have an economy which is functioning reasonably well. It doesn't make the economy function or not function on its own. So, and it's the same thing. There's another piece of flim-flam here where he talks about reducing the number of brackets in the income tax from 7 to 3. The number of brackets in the income tax is a table. It is not what makes the income tax complex. What makes the income tax complex is deductions and exemptions and definitions of income, which are there because income is a very complex concept, and so taxing it is complicated. The bracket issue is a pure red herring, but the effect of reducing the brackets is to reduce that top rate, which is mainly benefiting the highest income earners. It's a tax. It was what Reagan did. It's a tax relief for the wealthiest.
Well, he did say that he'd cut the top tax rate to 25% from its current 39.6%, did he not?
No, he said 33. That's what I have in the text here. But he then said, for many workers, their tax rate will be zero, except, of course, he didn't mention the Social Security tax. And for many American workers, perhaps most, the FICA tax is actually bigger than their income tax, because they're already getting, first of all, their incomes are not that high, and secondly, they already get substantial deductions on the income tax. So it's a to say their tax rate will be zero completely overlooks the fact that ever since the early 1980s, since that Reagan period, American workers have been paying extravagantly into the Social Security Fund that built up the enormous surplus that the Social Security Fund ran for 30 years or so.
Actually, I misspoke. Since I didn't see this speech, and you have a transcript of it, of course,
I got it right in front of you.
Yeah, I've been busy getting a program together, I must say.
Yeah, sure.
I didn't want to inflict...
the advantage of the interviewee.
Yes, I didn't want to inflict that pain on myself to have to sit down and watch the whole thing. Now, the change is from what he's proposed in September, which was to cut the top rates down to 25% from 39%. So he's changed a little bit since September.
Yeah, he's gone to the House Republican plan.
Plan, right, right. So the childcare plan, again, which sounds like it's user-friendly, my understanding is that it really only advantages upper middle class and wealthier families, and there's little to no benefit for most working families and low-income families. So what's your analysis of that idea that allowing...
I just see that he would allow people to deduct the average cost of childcare spending from their taxes.
Right.
In order for that to be a benefit, you have to take the deduction, the itemized deductions.
Right.
It is not a scheme which is going to reduce the cost of childcare for most working families.
Right. because for expenses of $10,000 a year on childcare, the tax deduction would be worth about $3,960 for a family in the top marginal tax bracket, making more than $467,000 a year, but only $1,500 to a family making between $19,000 and $75,000.
So, on balance, just flipping through this thing, what one sees is a rhetoric very strongly aimed at American working families, and particularly people who remember, have experience of the days of very strong American manufacturing, for which they have an understandable nostalgia, an understandable yearning, and then a set of proposals which are patched together from a very old Republican playbook, very old conservative playbook, which is basically every bit of snake oil that was peddled for 30 years, but with a few things which are obvious departures from the Republican tradition and which have obvious resonance for his audience. And I think the Clinton campaign needs to think carefully about how they respond on the trade issue. He says, for example, that it was Hillary Clinton's husband who signed NAFTA, and he says that NAFTA cost a great many people their jobs, and he says that that firms move their jobs, that they when you have free importation of goods that are not subject to regulations that are imposed at home, that this is going to cause companies to move their jobs over the border. And all of that is true. And so it seems to me that thinking about imaginatively about how to respond to that and how to make a persuasive response to the particular voters in the upper Midwest is a very crucial battleground here, is something the Clinton campaign is going to have to think about carefully.
Well, I don't think they are thinking about it carefully. I mean, first of all, we know that this speech was a nod to the Rust Belt and to the working people in the Rust Belt and those that support him and those that also voted for Bernie Sanders. My problem with both Hillary Clinton and President Obama is that they have these often these rosy accounts of the economy. I don't believe the people that are angry out there. I mean, the whole convention, the Democratic convention, was about saying the other side's all about peddling fear. I don't think they're peddling fear. They're exploiting anger. And until you address that anger, I think you have a major problem.
Well, I tend to agree with that. I must say, here's a line that I find interesting, given what I've just been saying. And Trump says, the U.S. economy is 25% smaller than it would have been without the surge of regulation since 1980. Now, 1980 is an interesting year to choose because whether the claim is right or wrong, who was elected in 1980?
Yeah, right.
I believe it was Ronald Reagan.
Right.
So if he's making that claim, it's right there in the speech. That is an interesting hidden comment on his view of the Reagan administration, which is contradicted by his general the generalized Reaganism of the rest of the rhetoric. Very interesting. Maybe a little bit undisciplined on his part, the part of his speechwriters.
But just in closing, though, just to zero in on how the Clinton campaign might or should combat this beguiling invitation to working Americans to drink the Donald Trump Kool-Aid. I mean, it's, first of all, the fact that he has support that he does have, and it's substantial support amongst white working class Americans, and that the strategy clearly is if he can win the states that Romney won and then reach out and win the Rust Belt, that's his only path to the presidency. So this is an important speech in that regard, since he's laying down the kind of gauntlet in inviting them in. What would your recommendations be for the Clinton campaign? Because they have essentially, to my mind, they've been presenting a very rosy picture and not, I mean, they're satisfied in their commercials of making fun of Trump because he does a good job on his own. But that's kind of smug liberal self-satisfaction, I don't think is going to make it. I think you've got to address the very people that Trump has won over.
I fully agree with you. I think there is an enormous danger in the strategy of, let's say, call it personal destruction. Maybe it will work, but let's not get past the point or ignore the fact that Donald Trump destroyed the entire Republican field. This is not a man without political talent. And he, as you say, clearly has followers, and his followers clearly have a very strongly developed sense of economic grievance, and they are clearly, the people he's appealing to are clearly concentrated in a series of states which have been substantially Democratic, and we are now in a situation in which the Democratic nominee is defending an economic record which hasn't been so great in those states. So I think they should, the Clinton people would be wise to recognize there's a point of vulnerability here, and they would be wise to think very carefully about how to address it, recognizing that there is, as I say, a genuine constituency out there, which has a legitimate claim on the serious attention of the president, who is about to be elected. It should not be treated as though they're simply people who are all beyond the pale. They're not. So, yes, I think what you say is exactly right. This is a question which may or may not prove significant in the larger scheme of things, but possibly could and should be taken seriously.
Well, James Galbraith, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with James Galbraith. He's a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also a senior scholar at the Levy Economics Institute and serves as the chair of the board of Economists for Peace and Security. And his latest book is Welcome to the Poison Chalice, The Destruction of Greece and the Future of Europe. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the crisis in journalism that the Trump campaign has brought about. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Mindich, who's a professor and former chair of Media Studies, Journalism and Digital Arts at St. Michael's College. He's the author of Just the Facts, How Objectivity, in quotes, Came to Define American Journalism, and has an article at the Columbia Journalism Review for journalists covering Trump, A Murrow Moment. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Mindich.
Thank you for having me.
And by a Murrow moment, of course, you are referring to the extraordinary moment which was captured in a movie about Edward R. Murrow, where Murrow used his extraordinary prominence as CBS, probably the most highly rated show on CBS in the days when all the eyeballs were on the three networks, where Murrow famously said, "This is no time for men who oppose Senator McCarthy's methods to keep silent, or for those who approve. We cannot defend freedom abroad by deserting it at home." Of course, we have not had our Murrow moment with Donald Trump, but with our much more diversified media and with an enormous number of Americans supporting Donald Trump and believing that there's such a thing as a liberal media and having contempt for the mainstream media, what kind of, if the moment were to happen, what kind of impact would it have?
Well, you know, certainly what you're saying about that we don't have all the eyeballs on one particular station is true. But I think we're seeing some Murrow moments now. I think that, Edward R. Murrow in 1954 used McCarthy's words against him. And I think we're seeing a lot of that among journalists today. Journalists are departing from the idea of objectivity in ways that they never have in presidential elections. And we're seeing, there were a couple of examples. One was Anderson Cooper when he was talking with Trump about Trump's posting a picture of Ted Cruz's wife. Trump said, well, he started it. And Anderson Cooper said, with all due respect, that's an argument of a five-year-old. That kind of pushback you might not hear in previous elections. Jake Tapper, also of CNN, said to Trump when Trump was talking about this judge, an American judge of Mexican origin, he said, you know, isn't your response the definition of racism? And so we are seeing a bunch of Murrow moments, I think, maybe not on the scale of 1954, but they're starting to add up.
But when you say they're using his words against him, it would seem to me the moral position, if that can be taken in journalism, would be to condemn the words when they happen or immediately thereafter.
Right. You know, so it's interesting because it's interesting that you say that because Murrow, most of Murrow's show used McCarthy's words against him. Like there's a string of quotes that were just outrageous. And then Murrow came on in the end and said those words that you said and really condemned McCarthy. So we're seeing a mix of that. The Megyn Kelly moment in one of the debates where she just repeated a string of insults that Trump had said against women. And Trump got all upset. He basically got upset that she correctly quoted his own words against him. So using one's own words against them is actually effective. But there are departures from journalists that are even stronger. For example, the Washington Post recently had a front page editorial. It's either the only time or one of maybe two or three times in its history to have a front page editorial and calling Trump a unique danger. So there are some really strong words by journalists that you really wouldn't have found in other presidential elections.
And to the question then of his own supporters, and we don't know how deep the support is, but they clearly believe there is such a thing as a liberal media. And I'm with the most liberal of the liberal media, which is the Pacifica Radio Network. And I know we have fewer and fewer listeners over the years and are facing bankruptcy. So we're not a powerful force in the media by any definition. And there's also this, you know, the mainstream media, which of course is condemned by both the left and the right. And Sarah Palin calls it the lamestream media. So given that kind of hostility to the very press that you're just talking about, CNN and others, which they don't watch, they clearly, if anything, watch Fox, how much of an impact then would this kind of calling him out, this Murrow moment, have?
Well, you know, certainly we are very distracted in today's world. And as you mentioned at the start, not all the eyeballs are on one thing. Certainly, people on the left and the right are going to discount what journalism says. But that doesn't mean that we can give up the mission. The mission is to tell the truth, to hold leaders accountable, to introduce parts of society to one another, to make democracy work better. And so, you know, we can lament the decline of journalism and the decline of credibility in journalism, but at the same time, this is a moment. This is a moment when journalists and politicians and citizens have to ask themselves whether one of the two candidates running for president is dangerous. Murrow asked that question and answered it in his own mind and to his public that McCarthy was dangerous. And I think a lot of journalists and a lot of Democrats and a lot of Republicans are starting to answer that affirmatively about Trump. And if you believe that Trump is dangerous, that his words are racist, that he has elements of almost fascism when he starts to talk about monitoring Muslims and excluding an entire religion from entering the country, then you speak up. You have a responsibility to speak up because, you know, this is a moment, and if you have grandchildren, you'll be talking, they'll be asking you, where were you in 2016 when this was all happening?
Now, of course, I have to correct you, David. There's not just Hillary and Trump running for president. There's a new character who's just threw his hat in the ring today, Evan McMullen, a 40-year-old Mormon, former CIA operations officer, although I've checked my CIA sources, they've never heard of him. But he was the policy director of the House Republican Conference Committee. So that's, I know I'm sounding a bit facetious, but but by the way, to give this man his due, and I want to find out more about him, obviously, he did write a very cogent tweet, which seems to be the new currency of political discourse, referring to Trump as a dangerous authoritarian, using law and order to accrue power. So he certainly seems to get it in the most fundamental way.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, one of the things that oftentimes journalists aren't willing to go out on a limb and take sides. In fact, journalists would prefer that they develop, a balance in their political reporting. And like, for example, if we look at the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or any other major newspaper, the chances are we won't know how the reporter is voted based on his or her straight news story. So balance and objectivity are scrupulously defended in the profession. So when you have a candidate that's very different, it's really hard to shed that detachment. But it happens every once in a while, and, you know, it happened in 1954 with McCarthy, and it appears to be happening to some extent with Trump. So that there are many people who are calling Trump dangerous, even within the Republican Party, really gives journalists a little bit of freedom to call him out as well.
Right, but they've chosen to put themselves in this kind of monastery of the binary notion that in the universe of discourse there's only an equal and opposite black and white opinion, and then if you have the Republican opinion, then you have the Democratic opinion. And the absurdity of that is, if you have to, if you interview a Holocaust survivor, you therefore have to interview a Holocaust denier. And this convention, the so-called fair and balanced convention, has led to the pseudoscience stopping the reality of global warming. It's led to equating creationism with evolution. And it puts a journalist in this ridiculous position of having no opinions, convictions, being a kind of monk in a bordello. To my to my mind, it's much more realistic, you know, not to forget about being balanced, but at least be fair. If you try to hide your biases, I think you're being dishonest, and I think the public picks up on that. So this scrupulous neutrality that everybody thinks is so holy, I think is bogus.
Right, and I think that the examples that you gave are excellent, that I don't think that there's a responsible journalist today who would balance a Holocaust story, and it's increasingly rare to see a balance of a global warming story. And so it's good that journalists depart from balance, the straitjacket of balance, and we see it not too often, though, in presidential campaigns, but we're seeing that vividly now in an echo of that Murrow moment in 1954, where this is the time when journalists abandon this forced notion of balance just because one of the candidates is so outrageous.
Well, I think that's the point, isn't it? That it's unrealistic to deny yourself as a participating human in the broader society, to pretend that what is so, the 900-pound gorilla in the front room is not a 900-pound gorilla in the front room. I mean, that's where I think it breaks down. And it's an odd convention to deny yourself. I mean, maybe that's why our politics are so sort of, you know, passive, that so few people vote, is because it's almost denying the passion and conviction of opinion.
Yeah. Well, you know, and there's no shortage of opinion on the broadcast news network.
Yeah, you're right there. I agree.
But the, you know, one thing is that I do want, if I'm going to hear an account of the trip that Obama took, I would prefer to at least have a few sources that I read to be non-cheerleaders or non-witch hunters. I mean, I think that there is a place for, you know, an honest appraisal, which is not exactly false balance. But, you know, so the question is, it's a difficult, I think that you're making some great points, and I think it's a very difficult way, a difficult balance, difficult balancing act that journalists do. Sometimes they get it right, sometimes they don't.
But just because we're running out of time, my sense, though, is that in Europe you have newspapers that cover a broad spectrum from the far left to the far right. Is that an answer? Because the reason we have this balance is because the newspaper owners and I guess the television owners figured out that if we half our audience are Democrats and half are Republicans, and if we alienate one half, we're going to lose half our audience. So that's why they came up with this idea of on the one hand and on the other hand, the Democratic position and the Republican position. Would it help if we had a more diversified media, not a sort of atomized media that we have now where you find your own truths, you do reality shopping, but a diversified media in terms of the political spectrum?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I was in Germany a few years back and meeting with a few German broadcasters. And broadcasters in America tend to at least put on the mask of nonpartisanship. But these Germans that I talked with all said, you know, if they don't know what my politics are, I failed, you know, which is the opposite of most American broadcasters.
Right. Well, I fit in that category, actually.
Right. So, I mean, and there's a place for all of that. But one thing that I will say is that it's very important for journalists of all stripes to subscribe to a fact-based understanding of the universe. So, so if someone says that global warming doesn't exist or that it's not man-made, they're wrong. You know, I mean, assuming that 98% of scientists are right, you know, you really need to follow the facts. And too often we see one group of politicians, and it's, I think, usually lately been the Republican Party, with less of an adherence to facts than others. And so journalists of all stripes need to call politicians out on that.
Well, David Mindish, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with David Mindish, who's a professor and former chair of Media Studies, Journalism, and Digital Arts at St. Michael's College. He is the author of Just the Facts, How Objectivity, in quotes, Came to Define American Journalism. And he has an article at the Columbia Journalism Review for journalists covering Trump, a Murrow moment. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back analyzing Donald Trump's authoritarian tendencies. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jonathan Weiler, who's the author of Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics. He is the director of Global Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Understanding Trump, It's Still the Authoritarianism Stupid. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Weiler.
Thanks, Ian.
And interesting enough, Jonathan, today there is a new candidate running for president challenging Donald Trump. He is a 40-year-old Mormon bachelor, formerly with the CIA, although I've yet to find out anybody through my CIA contacts who's ever heard of him. Supposedly he was with the operations side. But then, of course, if you're out there trying to recruit foreign nationals to spy for you, you're a Mormon, you can't even have a drink with them. Makes one wonder. But anyway, I digress. What I wanted to mention about this fellow, Evan McMullen, is that he recently tweeted, "Authoritarians like Donald Trump use promises of law and order to justify infringing on civil rights as they consolidate control by force." Not a bad summary, is it?
No, I'm impressed, actually, yes.
So why is it then that are we sort of hampered by this press convention that, you know, everything is equal and opposite, and now that he's the Republican candidate, he's an equal on the stage with Hillary Clinton and has to be dignified as such? I mean, why can't we really focus in on the obvious here? Because he's, you know, we know now that he's being scripted, both today at the Detroit Economic Club and then last Friday in Green Bay. And, you know, I just have this feeling that the fundamentally understanding who he is, which is the work that you've done, is really the important part here.
Well, Anina, Ian, to your point, last week Trump and his surrogate started floating the idea that if they don't win the election in November, it's because of a rigged voting system. And at President Obama's news conference last Thursday, one of the reporters asked him about, you know, that claim by Trump. And one of the things I saw watching that was, are you not giving credibility and credence to those kinds of outlandish claims, you know, just by asking a question at a press conference as if you're asking about tax policy? So, you know, I do think there's something about if a candidate sets such an extreme bar, then how do you cover that without essentially legitimizing his extremism?
Well, that's the challenge. I mean, and I don't know that I know there's an article in Monday's New York Times on the front page wrestling with that. And that's, yeah. We know that the Huffington Post has at the end of their articles, have a disclaimer saying who Trump really is. So efforts are being made. But just in general, though, to try and get this focus on who he is and what the pathology of this man is, you know, you can't get psychiatrists to talk about him because of the Goldwater rule, which came in after the 64 elections, where, you know, psychiatrists can't opine on the mental health of anybody unless they've actually treated them. But there seems to be pretty, I mean, I know the head of the Republicans overseas organization said that, went public and said he clearly has mental health issues. But let's start with the framing that George Lakoff and yourself also, you know, the idea of who the authoritarian is and this kind of strict father figure and why it works.
Well, yeah. So, you know, the authoritarian framework, which certainly I think in many ways is a close cousin of George Lakoff's moral political framework, essentially says that authoritarian-minded individuals, you know, tend to think of the world in very simple, clear, black and white terms defined by good and evil. The way you approach vexing problems is with simple, clear, direct solutions, preferably by imposing force on those solutions and really exhibiting just a fundamental disdain and contempt and probably even fear for any kind of approach to these issues that traffics in nuance or shades of gray or anything like that. And, you know, Trump is obviously in not only the substance of what he says, but in the language he uses, I think really checks all of those boxes.
And what does it say about the people who find authoritarianism appealing?
Well, I mean, I do think many
of Trump's supporters. You know, we know from surveys that have been taken throughout this campaign season are themselves authoritarian-minded, and so they tend to have this kind of black and white, us versus them, good versus evil worldview. And from that perspective, you know, Trump is very appealing because they see the world as filled with, and this is a really important point, filled with, you know, chaos and insecurity. They are particularly fearful and fearful of certain kinds of threats, threats coming from outsiders. And Trump is really speaking to them and speaking to the kinds of things that, you know, I would say keep them up at night.
So is this in some ways related to the comfort that religious fundamentalism provides people? Because, you know, the Christian right, in spite of the fact that this guy is a thrice divorced owner of gambling dens and is not your typical Christian candidate, they are voting for him in droves. So is there a connection there between authoritarianism and religious fundamentalism?
There's no doubt. You know, one thing we found in our book, Ian, was that there was a particularly strong connection between being authoritarian-minded and believing that the Bible is the literal word of God. And so there is certainly a very basic connection in worldview, I think, between authoritarianism on one hand and on the other, as you say, religious fundamentalism. You know, interestingly, though, there's been some work this year that suggests that evangelicals in the South, for example, have been much more were much more supportive of Trump during the primary season than evangelicals in the North. And that what was really driving a lot of that Southern evangelical support for Trump had to do with racial attitudes, so that many Northern evangelicals who were conservative in all sorts of ways nevertheless seemed to have kind of bristled at Trump's, you know, divide and conquer view of the world. So there's no question that there's an affinity, but there's also perhaps some interesting kind of regional nuances and distinctions here.
But, Jonathan, this goes beyond Donald Trump. There appears to be a global phenomenon happening out there with the rise of authoritarians. You've got Putin in Russia. You've got Erdogan in Turkey. You've got Xi Jinping in China. You've got Mugabe in Zimbabwe. He's been around for a while, of course, forever. And you've got this new character in the Philippines, Duterte. And, of course, you've got al-Sisi in Egypt, to name a few. So how do you characterize this as a global phenomenon, and what would be apparently driving it?
Well, so it's a good question, Ian. I think I'd make a distinction between the kinds of authoritarian leaders you just described. I mean, in some of those cases, Turkey, Russia, Egypt, there's clearly, you know, all of those leaders have a base of popular support, although how much support they have is a little bit hard to know because of the repressive nature of the, you know, each of those regimes. I think in some ways, what's more striking to me in relating Trump to larger global phenomena are what we're seeing in Western Europe, for example, the growing support for Le Pen's party in France, the near victory of a far-right party in Austria earlier this year, and of course the Brexit vote. And I think one thing that is happening is that a very substantial portion of the population in each of these countries, and this may be true in Egypt and Turkey and Russia as well, I just don't have as good a sense of it, is that the kind of working class and sort of lower middle class strata of those societies, they have seen their living standards stagnate in recent years. They are frustrated. They believe that the world is changing around them in ways that are hurting them and their families and communities, and they're looking for people who are going to provide what they believe is a compelling explanation for why they're suffering the way that they are.
So in other words, because reality is so frightening and frustrating, authoritarians invent their own realities, and that's what people buy into.
I think so. I mean, I think part of the reality that they're responding to, you know, there's a truth in it. And for example, this stagnation of wages, you know, in many places, for example. And then there's a willingness to respond to leaders who, even if their actual solutions to the problems at hand are not solutions at all, I think that's certainly true of Trump, for example, just this sort of clarity with which they communicate and speak to the fear and insecurity of many of these people is very appealing and enough to win a lot of folks over.
So in other words, the candidate who can sort of placate uncertainty is going to win. In other words, you know, I come out of the world of uncertainty in journalism. You know, you don't believe anything until it's proven.
Yeah.
And you sort of operate in the world of uncertainty, and you don't take comfort in certainty. In fact, you're suspicious of certainty.
Mm-hmm.
But certainty in a political world seems to be very appealing. And, you know, that is obviously, if you compare Trump to Clinton, he can say things with absolute certainty, whether they're true or false, and more often than not, they're false. But she sort of slavishly, particularly when she's talking about her emails, she slavishly tries to explain things rationally and reasonably and gets all tangled up. So it would seem in the political world, the candidate who offers certainty in an uncertain world has an advantage.
I would say no doubt. And, you know, Ian, it's interesting that you just used that phrase that, you know, you are suspicious of certainty. Rick Perlstein, the historian, in his most recent book about Ronald Reagan, The Invisible Bridge, talks about the kind of liberal left side of the political spectrum in the United States in the 60s and 70s. And he refers to them as the suspicious circles, you know, who bring a certain degree of skepticism to everything. And he portrays Reagan as kind of representing a backlash against that kind of sensibility. A guy who provides absolute certainty and clarity and an unwavering belief in a fixed reality. Whether that reality conforms with what's actually happening being in some ways very much beside the point. And so I think in many ways we're seeing a dynamic like that playing out now.
But I find, you know, right-wing dogma and left-wing dogma almost indistinguishable in the sense that they think they've got the answers. I mean, people who think they have the answers I find troubling because, you know, I don't have the answers and I'm looking for them. And so far, what I hear in terms of certainty, either on the left or on the right, doesn't make a lot of sense.
Right. And so, you know, it's interesting because, and I think this is true for most people, when we are facing, you know, really dire, threatening situations, I think it's a natural human tendency to start thinking in much more kind of simple flight or fight terms, you know. And so if you're continually bombarded with news about terrorist attacks, for example, and you fear for your very life and your children's lives and whatever, then I do think it's a kind of natural habit of the human brain to start to think in much more simple terms. And in a context like that, somebody who's able to deliver certainty is going to appeal to lots of people.
So we're going back to, what's the amygdala in the brain?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
that's right.
Which goes
that's
way
right.
back to, you know, primitive man. Fight or flight, you know, run away from the saber-toothed tiger or stand your ground, you know.
Exactly.
So we haven't really progressed. Is that what you're telling us?
Well, I guess what I would say, I mean, other parts of our brain have developed in the last 3 million years, but those parts of the brain are they are fragile, let us say,
right.
And easily vulnerable to situations like the one we find ourselves in now.
So back to in the last couple of minutes, Jonathan Wyler, back to this election and this contest between an authoritarian Donald Trump and a woman running for president. And, you know, just to quote George Lakoff, you know, the authoritarians, Republicans tend to be male, and the yielding, compromising females tend to vote Democrat. And obviously Hillary Clinton's pretty much got the Democratic vote. She's obviously trying to reach out to the Republicans or disaffected Republicans. But in terms of breaking that mold, what could Hillary Clinton be doing in terms of reaching out to these authoritarian males who seem to hate her so much? Because I've made the criticism often that she doesn't seem to be addressing the underlying anger that is driving people to support Donald Trump and to vote for Bernie Sanders.
Well, you know, it's an interesting question. I would say at this point, I'm not sure there's a whole lot she can do to appeal to really authoritarian-minded individuals. But one thing that's, you know, worth keeping in mind is that, like with everything else, this is a spectrum, right? So you've got people who are an extreme authoritarian end, people at an extreme non-authoritarian end, and a lot of people in the middle. And I think there are plenty of those people in the middle who, let's say, are a little more authoritarian than not, but can be appealed to on the basis of reason or, you know, other factors besides fear and insecurity. And for many of those people, the fact that a growing litany of national security types are actually lining up to endorse Hillary is probably going to serve her very well. And I think that this speaks to another interesting dynamic of this election, Ian, which is that on the one hand, Trump is appealing to authoritarians on the basis of fear and insecurity, and being the strong man is going to solve all their problems. On the other hand, he himself has in some ways come across as kind of unhinged, and as not a steady hand on the till. And I think to some degree, that undermines his authoritarian appeal, because the flip side of you feel fearful and insecure is I've got the strength and steadiness to make everything okay. And I think Trump, in the way he has performed, has kind of, you know, cut himself off at the knees to some degree because of his own erratic behavior. So I think there's an opening there for Hillary, again, not among the most extreme authoritarians, but among those who lean that way, but, you know, are still gettable voters.
Well, I think inside the strong man is is a weakling cowering. I mean,
a child, really.
Yeah, and I think that Donald Trump is a classic example of that. I thank you for joining us, Jonathan Wyler. I appreciate the conversation.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Wyler, who's the author of Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.